Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
As always, this episode of the Spurs Show podcast is sponsored by Greene King Sport, where football is more than a game. The league season is entering the business end, and Greene King Sport venues are showing every single televised Spurs fixture over the 23-24 season. And with more than 900 sports pubs across the UK, it doesn't matter where you're based, you can catch every single minute of the action. Football is best enjoyed with your mates. So if you're not at the ground this month, get a text in the group chat and head to your local Greene King Sports venue to catch the game. Don't forget to download the Greene King Sport app to enjoy exclusive competitions and discounts whenever there's a game on. Gentlemen, boys and girls, Spurs fans around the world, Theo Delaney here saying welcome to another Spurs show. And Tottenham Hotspur, it's happened again. Just when we were all walking around like the cats that got the cream at Villa Park, we've gone and got savagely mauled by, of all teams, Fulham down at lovely old Craven Cottage. And Craven, for many of us, doesn't even begin to cover the supine nature of the Spurs performance. We'll be moaning about that, assessing where it leaves our bid for Champions League football next season, looking forward to the Women's FA Cup semi-final with Leicester, talking about an exciting new book on Spurs in the 90s entitled Is Gascoigne Going to Have a Crack? And looking forward to our special live show on Wednesday with the great Paul Gascoigne at the Leicester Square Theatre. And joining me to talk about all this and more, welcome back, first of all, Mitch Lee. Morning, or it's not really morning, is it, unless you're in Australia. Good evening, Mitch.
Yeah, how are you, Theo? All right.
Very good. Nice to have you back. Also returning from the Daily Mail, Mr. Paul Newman. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Theo. Thanks very much for having me back.
Great to see you. And the author of the aforementioned book, Is Gascoigne Gonna Have a Crack? Gareth Date is here. Hi, Gareth.
Hi, Theo. Delighted to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you on. I've had a brief look at your book. You were kind enough to send me a pre-publication PDF, and I've got to say it is a mouth-watering proposition. So we'll get on to that in some detail later on. But obviously there's only one place to start. I'm sorry, gentlemen, but we cannot avoid it. And that is what happened on Saturday. Now, I went with my two uncles who are, that, you know, you're probably thinking, it's two uncles. What were they? My God, they probably had to be wheeled in, but I've actually got very young uncles. One of them's only 5 years younger than me, and one's a bit older than that. So, older than me. Anyway, so we went and we sat right behind the goal, low down, which I never do at Tottenham. I sit in the West Stand, quite high up near the halfway line, and it is as we all know, it's a very, very different experience when you're down low behind the goal. It couldn't be any more different. So you kind of, the last time I did that was at Southampton, exactly a year ago, when Conte lost his rag afterwards. And it felt a bit like that. It felt like a strangely negative game. But at the same time, I felt like I hadn't really seen it in the detail that I might have done if I'd been in a different seat or if I'd watched it live on the telly. Mitch, tell us what you made of it.
I actually saw your picture on Facebook. I thought, well, lucky you, you done well to get a ticket for that one.
Yeah, but,
I really didn't want to come on a show and be negative, but there's just not that much you can say about that performance. It was Fulham just did a job on us. They really did. I think they looked at the Villa game from last week and thought, I think they just analysed it and thought, how can we beat Spurs? This is what we need to do. They looked at Maddison, Kulusevski, and they kind of marked them out of the game, really. They, you know, so much so that they scored at the right time just before half time. So your team talks all differently. And it got to an hour, and then I've never seen this happen before, but he took his whole midfield off. He took all of them off in 66 minutes. He thought, this ain't working. All of them off and changed it all. And I think when your midfield goes, you know, it's the heart of your team. And that meant that Fulham knew they were doing the right things, and they were frustrating us. And the thing with Spurs is you'll always get a chance against Spurs. We'll always, because we play the high line, they always know they'll get in. If they take those chances, then we just kind of crumbled. And I think not just me, but I think as a club, maybe everyone, I think that we're all a bit complacent, maybe. We'd seen the Villa game and everyone's doing their predictions for the end of the season. And Fulham was almost like, yeah, we'll get 3 points there, and almost dismiss them. Fulham are a half-decent team when you look at their players. They've got a lot of good players. And I think that, you know, this is me as well, because I was looking up, I'll do that 3 against Fulham. And we got really mugged off there. And you know, I got to 75 minutes. I thought, I can't watch this anymore, because, you know, sometimes the fight and the comeback is on. It just didn't really.
Yeah.
When Werner missed that chance, it was, you know, I mean, it was gone. It was gone then. So it, I'm just kind of lost with where we were that game. It just kind of killed me.
Yeah. Nobody really saw it coming, did they? I mean, it was probably, I think Villa away was possibly the best performance of the season. And this was undoubtedly, from my point of view, I thought it was the worst performance of the season. Paul, do you think some sort of deep subconscious complacency might have been the problem?
I think so, Theo. I think complacency is the word, actually. Mitch used it, and I think that's the only thing I can come up with, really. As you say, none of us saw it coming. It was a truly awful performance. None of the intensity we've come to expect was there. None of the energy and the passion, really. And I can only put that down to that they were expecting to win. We've got a great record against Fulham, haven't we, in recent years? They've barely beaten us at all for as long as I can remember. But they have got a decent side, and they have got a very good home record. Marco Silva hadn't won against Spurs, had he, in about 8 games, I think, for 3 different clubs. So it had all the ingredients of a disaster for us, really. But I'm just trying to put it down as one of those things. I'm trying to put it down as a one-off. We haven't been playing well for a while, have we, really? But we were absolutely fantastic at Villa. I thought that everything had come together again. I you know, as we all did, I'm sure. I thought we were now on our path to fourth place. I still believe that we are the favourites for fourth place. I'm not convinced by Villa. I was quite pleased United beat Liverpool in the Cup, because I think that will distract them. So I'm slightly worried about United more than Villa, actually, for that fourth place. But this season has been so good in so many ways. I'm enjoying my football again, that I'm just trying not to let it to upset me too much, really. And I just have faith that we'll put it right. It's very disappointing. We've got the international break now. We have to wait for 2 weeks and stew on it until the Luton game. But I am hoping it's a one-off. I am hoping that they were hurt by it. If I have got any sort of smidgen of worry in my mind, it's just Ange's lack of flexibility, really. He has, you know, there's not too much change in the way he plays. And I think there are minor alterations to the way he plays. I think it's too simplistic to say he doesn't change at all. But Fulham did do a job on us, didn't they? Just as Wolves did a job on us, and just as Palace almost did before we blew them away. And I think that does give us food for thought as we move forward under Ange. But that it's a minor thing. I'm convinced that we are going to go places under this manager. I'm convinced we are one club altogether again. And I very much hope this is a blip, really, and we'll soon put it behind us.
Yeah. I mean, after that Villa game, they were so good at Villa, weren't they? I mean, the first half at Villa was reasonably even, but I think we were really well on top in terms of possession. So, and then the second half, we were absolutely excellent and we just completely took them to the cleaners. But after that game, I thought, wow, we were so good. And then I thought, actually, that was the best 11. I think that was actually the best 11. And I think that's the first time. Even early in the season when he seemed to be playing, when we didn't have many injuries or anything, he was still sort of trying to find his best 11. But when they, but that team at Villa, you looked at it 1 to 11, you thought, I don't think I would have played anyone else in any position other than who he picked in that game. And that might explain how good we were. And here we were a week later with one change, one enforced change, but it was crucial because he was the one, he's the one player, isn't he? Van der Ven, I'm talking about, who is... We don't have a direct replacement for because we don't have anyone that good in that position. We certainly don't have anyone that quick in that position. In fact, nobody does because he's officially the quickest player there is. And our, you know, in the Premier League, and our way of playing, of course, as everyone knows, means we leave a lot of space behind him. And whenever, when Van der Ven does play, I mean, regularly see him sprinting back at 23 miles an hour. That's what he's been clocked at. And, you know, snuffing out, you know, very dangerous situations. And, you know, Dragishin played, it was his first start. You can't expect him to be immaculate on, you know, when he's never started a Premier League game before. And he, as I say, nobody, not Dragishin, no, nobody else is as quick as Van der Ven. Now, I actually felt that like that one change seemed crucial because at halftime we were still in the game, of course. They had scored, but you wouldn't have been surprised if we'd gone in at 0-0. Do you think, Gareth, that might have been one of the main reasons for this problem on Saturday?
Yeah, as you said, Van der Ven is so good, isn't he? And Dragushin, who I'm sure we're going to be really, really pleased with, that it is, as you said, it is one of his first start. It's, I think, only his fifth appearance. He's trying to come to terms with a new division where there's, you know, a different tempo and a different intensity about the game. But look, I certainly don't think it was on him. I think Ange said it was, and Sonny said, didn't they? It's about no individuals here. This was very much a collective performance, and I'm sure that's how they'll take it. But look, every great player we've had, every great centre half that we've had, and you will have all have seen plenty of them. They all would have had one of those first opening games where perhaps it didn't quite work out for them, and that's all part of the learning process, which I think in the wider context is probably where we are at the moment, that there's going to be plenty that we're going to learn about and probably learn about the hard way for a few months. But this is all part of the, dare I say it, the process.
Yeah. What do you think? Do you think there, I mean, we've talked about complacency, we've talked about the lack of Van der Ven. Do you think there was anything else in particular that struck you about their, what went wrong?
I think both Paul and Mitch alluded to it. I think Fulham are a very good side. I think they're the only team that have taken 4 points off Arsenal this season. They had a real ding-dong with Liverpool and narrowly got beaten in stoppage time up at Anfield earlier in the year. So look, I think they're a really good team. They're probably slightly further ahead in their development because Marco Silva's been there a couple of seasons now, hasn't he? So they're well drilled in what they're doing. But look, sometimes you have these sorts of days. It's not only is it a team in development, it's also a young team. And I think what you see with teams like that is that they can't perhaps consistently play at the high level that they played against Villa last week. I mean, it's a shame that we've seen such a contrast within what the space of 6 days. But I think that's probably just where we are as a team at the moment, and probably at the start of the season, the number of points that we've got at the moment is probably where we would have hoped to have been, not even necessarily would have been.
I mean, at halftime, we went in and got a cup of tea, and I said, because I'm always the glass half full, I said, I think we'll be all right here. I think we'll win this. We're fine, because actually, if you looked at the game, I think Fulham had more chances and Vicario had to make more saves. It was a pretty open game. There were definitely chances at both ends. And actually, Spurs had missed two big chances. Son missed a big chance and Maddison missed a big chance. I'm not saying they were easy chances, but for players of their quality, on another day, both of those would have gone in and we'd have been winning at halftime. So I'm thinking to myself, it's fine. We're making chances. It's an even game, and we tend to get better as the game goes on. But of course, we come out, and they really came at us early. And that second goal they got was a bit fluky, wasn't it? It came off the guy's thigh. He just basically threw it, vaguely sort of moved in the direction of the ball, and it all worked out very well for him. And then the third goal was a scramble. wasn't it? It was a scramble. And but I mean, I think one of the commentators, I watched some highlights today, but I couldn't. But once we've lost, I can't watch anything or do anything all weekend. But I made myself, because I knew I was doing this, watch some very brief highlights today. And the commentator said that third goal summed up Spurs today because, you know, the guy Muniz got to it before any Tottenham player reacted, and that Spurs were slightly off it, which I suppose we've sort of alluded to by saying there was that slight complacency. And once you take, in the Premier League, you take 1% off your intensity, you're going to, you know, against... there aren't many teams that won't be able to capitalise on that. And Fulham, like you said, you know, they played very well against Liverpool, taking 4 points off Arsenal. They also won at Old Trafford the other week, didn't they? Mm. I mean, they are, at the moment, they look a good side. They have the occasional unexpected defeat as well, which is why they're not further up the table. But they are good. And I don't know, I felt we were in the game until that third goal went in. Even when a third goal went in, I was thinking back to that Brighton game. Do you remember the Brighton game, Mitch? Don't laugh, yeah. Mitch. Remember the Brighton game? I mean, we were 4-0 down and we scored twice and we looked like we were all over them. We were going to get something.
I did as well. And do you know what I was thinking? That when we've ended up playing the least amount of games for God knows how long. So I thought all these players were all well-rested, and the second half at Villa was going to show that, because we just turned it on in the second half. And I thought we'd maybe see a bit of that. We were 1-0 down, yeah. Come out in the second half, we've got more energy. We're playing one game a week, in some cases even one game every 2 weeks. You know, and I think to myself, these players are going to be up for this. They've got all the energy. But it fizzled out. It got even worse, if anything. So I don't know if it's better, because the managers moan if we play too many games. It seems like they're not happy if we don't play enough games. So I don't know. And sorry, when you're talking about commentary, you watched it today. Please, please, please. Why do we have to have Alan Smith commentating on our games?
I'm sorry. Yeah. It's been that way for years.
I know he's trying to be impartial. I know he is. But deep down in his heart, he is good. Right?
When
they score, you know he's laughing at us. I'll just have to bring that out. I'm sorry. It kind of ruins my viewing.
There's been going on for years and years and years. And every time you get him, it's not just, I mean, you know, I understand he's a very nice man. You know, he's certainly an intelligent man. He writes his own copy. He trained, apparently, to be a journalist after he came, because all of those other sort of football columnists have ghostwriters. He does it all himself. So let me just say that first. But when it's Alan Smith, you just think, oh, no. They're trolling. It's like Sky are trolling you. They're saying, oh, let's give Tottenham fans Alan Smith again. They hate it. Absolutely. And it's not just that you can tell that he loves Spurs losing, but it's also... he's got such a strangely sad demeanor. Do you know what I mean? He sounds quite miserable when he's doing the job. You think, Alan, it's a great job. Just enjoy it.
I would rather turn the volume down, listen to it in another language. I really just.
Yeah, it doesn't help. Obviously, we're much more sensitive to it when we're playing badly and losing.
Exactly.
The only other, he does have one other allegiance, and that's to Leicester. So that year when bloody Leicester won the title and we were supposedly in the title, made it even doubly bad, because he was like, he was willing us to lose every... Still, never mind, let's not get... We're getting distracted. I mean, you know, we can't blame Alan. We cannot blame Alan as much as we'd like to. We cannot blame Alan Smith for that performance. It was just poor. Postecoglou in the post-match, I saw a post-match interview and made myself watch as well, and he seemed, you know, of course, crestfallen, and like we all were, but he always remains quite consistent in what he says. He always says, look, we'll keep going, we'll do the same thing, we'll be doing the same thing. He never seems to panic. He never seems like he's going to change anything. He seems really quite even... You know, he remains calm when things go wrong, and he remains generally positive. But at one point, the interviewer said to him, do you think you caused yourself a problem now going for top four? And he said, oh, yeah, it's all over. We'll just aim for sixth now. And I thought, oh, he can be riled. He can be riled then. But, I mean, some people, you know, every time we lose, and which isn't very often this season, but we have lost a few. I mean, when we lost to Wolves the other week, people are straight out the woodwork, aren't they, having a go, saying, you know, oh, it's all Ange's fault and all of this. I mean, like you said, I don't think any of us here are worried about Ange, are we?
No, absolutely not. I've been incredibly impressed with the guy all the way along, as I'm sure we all have. I absolutely think he's the manager for us. When you compare it as you say, Theo, that defeat by Southampton last year was virtually exactly a year ago, and we were at such a low ebb. But I'd become so disillusioned with Conte that I was glad to see the back of him. I think this guy has united us all. He's got everybody on the same side. The academy team are playing good attacking football. The women's team on the same page. So I've certainly got no qualms that he's the right man, or any real worries. I mean, you look at when Klopp and Arteta both started at Liverpool and Arsenal. I think they finished eighth their first season. I really didn't expect us to be fifth at this stage at the start of the season. I just wanted to enjoy my football again. I've certainly done that on the whole. You know, and days like Saturday, you do think, well, where on earth did that come from? You know, we're so good the previous week. But I do think there are going to be bumps in the road, as Ange just said. I think he has become a little bit irked with this talk of fourth place, isn't he? Because he doesn't see it as the be-all and end-all. And I can understand. Yeah. I mean, it didn't do us any favours the season before last when Conte got us there, really, because the following season was a disaster where Arsenal made progress. It's not done Manchester United or Newcastle any favours this season, has it? And it's not the be-all and end-all to where we want to go, I think. I do think he's in it for the long haul. He said he'll be happy finishing fifth if he can see that we're progressing and we're getting to where we want to be. I still think he wants to, you know, get a few more of his own players in. So really, I'd be happy with fourth, fifth or sixth, I think. If we go any lower than that, I think it'd be a bit of an implosion from here. But I absolutely think he's the best man, and I want him to be our manager for some considerable time. And I do think we're gonna go on to have a decent finish to the season, but there will be bumps in the road, and we're still early on in our development as a side, and I think it's inevitable, really, when we think about it.
Yeah, I mean, he also I think his thing is he's saying wherever we finish this season, it's not really what I'm interested in. I'm interested in building something and getting better and better, so that we actually stop worrying every year about whether we can get fourth, and we start thinking about whether we can get first. He doesn't actually say, he hasn't said those words, but I think that's basically what he's saying. He's saying, let's actually look to the medium to long term and build a team that is a contender. And that way, when you get in the Champions League, you get in it to be competitive. Whereas, as you say, with Manchester United and Newcastle, they were never going to be competitive, and it just became a distraction. They were never good enough at any point to be in the running for the Champions League. And if you're not good enough to be competitive in it, you might as well not be in it. Why not? That's the whole point of having tiered competitions. I mean, look at the old Appiamas who sing "We're Champions of Europe." I mean, they were in the third one, the sort of tin pot one, but they're better off in one like that because they're competitive in that one. And this year they're in the Europa, aren't they? And they're quite competitive in that. Bless them. Lovely.
And Ange, in the whole of his career, hasn't he? Has gone for top place. That's all. That's what he wants.
Yeah.
Admittedly, in lower leagues, we all know that, but he's reaching for the stars. And I thought, you know, I've worked in journalism a long time. You see so many managers come out with all sorts of cliches and playing expectations down. And we've had loads of that, haven't we, with Conte and Mourinho the last few years, always playing expectations down, always, oh, you should be lucky, you should consider yourselves fortunate that we even got anywhere near the top four. We're nowhere near as good as all these other sides. So I thought earlier in the season when Spurs fans were saying, could we? You know, when we went on that amazing run early doors, are we really title contenders? Somebody put it to Ange, should you be playing this down? Should you be making sure people don't get too carried away? And he just said, let them dream. Let them dream. It's up to us to fulfil their expectations. And I thought that was the best thing I'd ever heard from a manager, really. And long may he have the attitude. He's reaching for the stars. And if it takes us 2 years to get there, 3 years to get there, I do genuinely believe we can become contenders under Ange. I really do. If he gets the right backing from the board, we've seen the board cock things up in the past, haven't we? But if everybody's in this together, you know, there's no limit to what we can achieve, I think.
Yeah, I agree. Well, we certainly have seen the board cock things up in the past, this board and previous boards, and we'll probably come on to a bit of that in a while, because we're going to talk about Gareth's book. But before we do that, let's have a short break.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, Quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
This episode is supported by FX's Clipped, the scandalous story of the 2014 Clippers owner's racist remarks captured on tape and heard around the world. The series charts the tape's impact on a dysfunctional basketball organization striving to win against their reputation as the most cursed team in the league. Starring Lawrence Fishburne, Jackie Weaver, Cleopatra Coleman, and Ed O'Neill. FX's Clipped, streaming June 4th, only on Hulu.
For premium content, including a daily news show, ex-player interviews, and original documentary series on Spurs, go to patreon.com/Spurs Show and support our show in the process. For Spurs Show merchandise, check the link in the notes to this show. We've got all sorts of wonderful garments and accessories, you know, Sony things. We've got Postecoglou things. It's absolutely a smorgasbord of delight. Our monthly London live shows are up and running. We had Peter Taylor on recently. It was absolutely excellent. It's a great time to sign up now, because if you go to season.spursshow.net and buy a season ticket, you should be able to get yourself into this Wednesday's huge event at Leicester Square Theatre, where we welcome Paul Gascoigne as our special guest. I can't tell you, this show's been going, I think it's something like 18 years, maybe more. And we've always wanted to have Paul Gascoigne on. And this Wednesday, we're just 2 days away from welcoming Gazza. I am absolutely beside myself. I'm not even sleeping. So try and get along to that. You can either sign up for a season ticket, or there are tickets. There'll be a link in the notes to this. There are a few tickets left. And on May the 23rd, by the way, our traditional end of season party, the biggie, we've got Danny Rose. So, again, if you get yourself a season ticket, you'll be getting into that. And, again, there are individual show tickets with a for them. You can check out the link in the description of this podcast. So, lots of great stuff coming up live-wise. I'm being told there are a few meet-and-greet spaces left for Gazza. Those are the premium tickets where you actually get to meet the man, spend time with him, which could be quite something. Follow us on Facebook, X, and Instagram, and please leave us a nice review on Apple Podcasts. Next week, it's me again with Jeff Pope, Mark Trainus, and David Harris. So, gentlemen, I just wanted to quickly mention the women's team, because it suddenly occurred to me they had that brilliant victory in the quarterfinal of the Women's FA Cup against Manchester City. Man City, money bag City. They're a big force in women's football, just as they are in men's football, and we knocked them out of the FA Cup, but it was a bit of an upset, and we're now in the semi-finals of the FA Cup against Leicester, which means we could find ourselves at Wembley in the final if we can get past Leicester, who are in the Premier League, but I think, you know, they're not a force. That we got the draw was kind to us, because in the other semi-final you got Chelsea, Man U. Mind you, Man U are around about the same sort of position as us in the Premier. Chelsea obviously are a massive force. They've got Emma Hayes, big Tottenham fan, by the way, who's the best manager in women's football, is just about to go off to manage the US national team. But if we get through that semi-final, yeah, we'll be at Wembley in the cup final. So I went online and thought, I will want to go to that if that happens. It's already sold out, you know, for general admission. But when they know who's in the final, they will release 12,000 tickets to each of the competing clubs. But that is a fantastic achievement, isn't it, Gareth?
Oh, it is. Yeah, it's a fantastic achievement. They're a very young team as a club as an entity. They're in their infancy. So they beat Leicester in the WSL yesterday. So the same team they're playing against in the semi-final. They won 1-0 at Brisbane Road yesterday. So I'm sure they won't be complacent though going into that semi-final. I think whichever of Spurs or Leicester get to the final, it'll be the first time that they've been in an actual FA Cup final, whereas Manchester United and Chelsea, I think the other semi-final, didn't it?
Chelsea, yeah. Yeah.
I think they've been in several semi-finals over the years. So
yeah.
Great achievement for our team. You think they beat Arsenal earlier just before Christmas, didn't they, at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium? And let's hope that the semi-final is equally as momentous.
And am I right in saying, Gareth, that at Wembley you do the commentary for the visually impaired fans? So you would you be working on that game?
Potentially. Well, it's the same weekend as our men's first team game against Burnley. And of course, we don't know when the Burnley game's going to be yet. So whether I come and watch the men on the season ticket or I'm working at Wembley.
Right. Hello, Wembley. Yeah, I can't make it. Spurs are at home. Sorry. See ya. You'll have to get someone else.
Saves me ringing my wife and saying I won't be home because Spurs are playing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I really, really would love to see Spurs get to that cup final. That would be fantastic. I mean, I'd love to see any Spurs team to get to any cup final this stage. But I mean, that would be a particularly impressive achievement, as you say, because Tottenham Hotspur women are a young team. They've only been in the Premier League, 3 years? And so it would be amazing. They'd most likely play Chelsea, which would be... quite a game, especially with Emma Hayes being a Tottenham fan. I don't think she likes to talk about that too much, but I think many years ago she came on the Spurs show as a Spurs fan. Yeah. Let's move on from that. Gareth, let's talk about your book, because, of course, this is Paul Gascoigne. This is officially Paul Gascoigne week on the Spurs show, because we've got him on Wednesday at the Leicester Square Theatre. Your book is called... Is Gascoigne going to have a crack? Nobody here will need that explaining, because we all remember, but we've all watched between us. I calculate we have watched that goal and that commentary 33 million times on YouTube, because that is one of the greatest moments in the history of Tottenham Hotspur, isn't it? That pre game. I was actually there. I was in the ground, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, brilliant, wasn't it? Well, I mean, it just took your breath away.
I'll just tell you something quick, because I remember that the game started at 12 o'clock, didn't it?
Yeah.
And I remember by 10 past 12, we were 2-0 up.
Yeah.
I thought, we can't hold on for 80 minutes. So I sat there, just like terrified for 80 minutes,
yeah.
Just biting my eyes like this. I couldn't believe we were 2-0 up, because obviously they were the better team going for the double, and
yeah.
We were little old Tottenham rocking up, and we weren't expected to be that. And the goal was just out of nothing, you know?
Yeah, and it's funny you say that, because, you know, the goal that I said, the Gascoigne goal was so early and so incredible that basically there was that moment in a stadium where there was a split second of total silence, because it was shock. It's one of those goals. They say they happen sometimes where the whole stadium's coming to terms with what they've just seen. They just couldn't believe it. Whereas it was the third goal where I went mad, because, as you say, that was the goal where you thought, I think we're actually going to do this.
That was the goal.
Yeah, I went absolutely insane, lost my mind, threw myself at the perimeter fencing. I was going bonkers at the front of the ground.
Still the best game I've ever been to.
Me too. Best game I've ever been to. And I walked out of that ground singing, "You've lost that double feeling. Where's your double gone?
No, we were singing, "We beat the scum 3-1. That was what I mean.
Beat the scum 3-1. Exactly. I mean, absolutely fantastic day. And of course, it set up your book, Gareth, because your book tells the story of Tottenham in the 90s. And that high point was never to be. I mean, we never got close. The feeling of euphoria and ecstasy we had that day, the closest we ever came to getting that again in the 90s was the final, but it wasn't quite as intense. And then after that, we just won one league cup, didn't we? Lots of Tottenham fans of our sort of age, we talk about the 90s in quite negative terms. We kind of dismiss it. Oh, you should have been there in the 90s. These youngsters, they don't know. We all sat through the 90s. On reflection, you are now a leading authority on Tottenham in the 90s. This is a very, I can, you know, from what I've seen, this is a meticulously researched book. You've talked to lots and lots of people on the inside. So you know Tottenham in the 90s better than anyone now, I would say. How bad was it?
Well, yeah, I mean, you're right. It was the era that I grew up in. And I guess for the people of your era, Theo, and I spoke to you and you've contributed some fantastic memories into the book as well. I spoke to Mike as well. And I guess if you followed Spurs in the 80s, where, you know, it was trophy laden, wasn't it, at the start of the 80s? Well, the 90s really is very much that poor relation to it. So was it that bad? The subtitle of the book is Spurs in the 90s, a decade of magic, mayhem and mediocrity. And I think when I first started writing it, it was very much on the basis of, you think things are bad now or you don't enjoy what's going on at the moment. As you've said there, you should have been around in the 90s. But I mean, actually, when you think about it, it did have an equal measure of magic, mayhem and mediocrity across the decade. So that Gascoigne goal in the FA Cup in 91 is definitely the high point. We had the League Cup win in 1999, which perhaps wasn't as glorious, but that team was spearheaded by Ginola, who I think a lot of people will remember as, you know, they put him in that sort of pantheon of, you know, of Gascoigne's. And so on, who have been brilliant. And then we had that season right bang in the middle, which I was really, really pleased that I got your memories on when we signed Jurgen Klinsmann. Mm. But that whole 94-95 season when, I mean, it ended tragically in the end, didn't it, with the defeat at Everton in the FA Cup semi-final, having beaten Liverpool in, I would say, maybe after that Arsenal semi-final, the next best or most enjoyable, memorable victory of the 90s at Anfield, to then go and lose at Everton in the semi-final was fairly horrific. But that season contained so many highs and lows. You had the start of the Aussie famous five when he put five forwards on the pitch, and for about three or four games at the start of the season, you thought, well, look, we're going to win every game about 4-0 this season. And of course, that didn't work out, and we lost 3-0 at Notts County in a League Cup tie. And
I was there.
That was pretty horrific. And then with the whole Klins mania at the start of the year, and of course he left us at the end of the season, and the aftermath of Alan Sugar and not wiping his Carl windscreen with a shirt. And then I guess in between those two trophy seasons and that 94-95 season, you've got a couple of times where you felt we had a really good team in development. So that 92-93 team, I always remember very affectionately. I was only 11, 12 years old at the time. But the team of Sheringham, Anderton and Barmby, and we had a much younger, a much fitter looking Neil Ruddock playing at the back, who we thought were finally
he was brilliant.
That we needed in defence. Yeah. It was Terry Venables was, well, he'd kind of gone upstairs. It was Ray Clements and Doug Livermore who were sort of running the team on a day-to-day basis. But Venables was very much involved in it. And then, of course, that all blew up at the end of the season because he had the big falling out with Sugar and ended up leaving. And then we were back to square one and, you know, Ruddock left. And the following year, we ended up in a relegation battle.
Yeah. So, I mean, the one kind of ever-present throughout the decade was Sugar, wasn't it? He comes in 91 and he leaves at the end of the decade. So he really was the defining character. Absolutely. I interviewed him once about him in Tottenham. And I went to his office. And he kept me waiting for ages, obviously. It was on film. So we had a whole... And he walks in, and I thought... first thing I asked him, because this was the perception of Alan Sugar, was that he wasn't really a football man. He was a businessman, but he had some... So I said to him, look, when you first came in, you know, the perception was that you weren't really a football man as such. You were a Spurs fan, but that you weren't, you know... Understandably, you're a businessman, and that's actually what we needed at the time. And he just totally lost his temper immediately. First question, what do you mean I wasn't a football man? What do you mean? What, just because I never stood at an away game in the pouring rain at Scunthorpe in the League Cup or something, you think that don't make me a football man? You know what you're talking about? I thought he was going to throw me out. So, I mean, that perception of him as not being, as being some sort of bloke who was... not really one of us and had come in and he was all about the money. What did I mean, he was the defining figure, wasn't he? Do you think of the 90s? I mean, he was the only one, as I say, who was ever present, wasn't he?
He was absolutely, the leading protagonist throughout the period. But we've got to be very grateful for him because if he hadn't come in when he did, I mean, he was part of this dream ticket with Terry Venables. So they were supposedly going to manage the 11, which is the title of one of the chapters, which was that Sugar was going to manage the £11 million overdraft and Terry Venables was going to manage the 11 on the pitch. But what I think people often forget is if Alan Sugar hadn't come in when he did with Venables, the club would probably have been sold to Robert Maxwell. And when that didn't bear thinking about what, you know, what might have happened, had that happened, because that was 6 months before he died. And of course, then his
finances were exposed.
And crumbling down.
Yeah, no, I always thought that. I remember that at the 91 final. I remember it's the only time I've ever actually got. I don't normally. I'm not one of those criers at football. You know, when they cut to someone in the stand crying because someone's won or lost. I'm not a crier, but I did shed a tear when we won the cup in 91. And it wasn't just because we'd won the cup. It was because I felt like the club had been saved, because it was the perception was sugar will come in if we get into Europe, because Sugars thinks we've got a chance, the extra revenue, and it's so much better for the brand if we're in Europe. And if we've got to win this game to get into Europe, we got in order to get Sugar to make the Venables Sugar package work, and that's what happened. So yeah, I mean, and he also did run it well. He certainly turned it from, he made a colossal profit on it, because he turned it from a business that was more or less basically bust and 11 million quid in debt. By the time he sold it, it was an extremely valuable asset, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, it was. He, I spoke to both Jerry Francis and David Howells, and you know, certainly David Howells said that the few times that they saw Alan Sugar, he often made quite a good impression on the, you know, on the players.
Mm. Yeah, but a lot of players stay different, don't they?
A lot of players say differently, yeah.
And former players as well. I mean, Steve Perriman's not terribly fond of him, for example.
No.
Nor is Neil Ruddock.
No, Neil Ruddock definitely yeah. wasn't. I mean, there's a picture in the book there of his then wife holding a sign outside Sugar's mansion saying, "We want tea, not sugar." That was...
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. I mean, I people might not remember or realise how, you know, sort of mutinous that was at the time. That so many players were with Venables, weren't they?
Were you going much in the 90s?
Yeah, it was something of a sort of not forgotten decade for me, but it was I was a child of the 80s. You know, I was there in 81, 82, and 84. Yeah. By the time the 90s came along, I had my two kids in the 90s, 91 and 95. I was trying to become a cricket writer at work. So it was a decade that I sort of wasn't as close as the rest of my life. But I do remember it all vividly. I wasn't keen on Sugar. We all sided with Venables, didn't we? He drove Venables away. I didn't think he was a proper football man. I think you can tell that now, you know, it came across in everything. And I think you must have just hit a nerve, mustn't you, Theo, when him reacting
like, it was
true. But when I think of the 90s now, I think of it starting fantastically with I think Paul Gascoigne played some of the best football that has been played by any English player of all time in that season. Then, of course, it ended. So the bittersweet FA Cup final of 91, as you were talking about finances there, it was perceived that we really needed that money from Lazio at the time, wasn't it, to survive as well? Yeah. And the whole transfer was in jeopardy. And I don't think he was ever quite the same player after that. No. He was still an excellent player, but some of the football we played that season. And then I remember going through the decade, the end of the 90s, I was at that League Cup final in 99 with my 8-year-old daughter and my 80-year-old mother, who were both sort of bowing to Ginola. I have this vivid memory of that as well, and us all singing "Man in Raincoats, Blue and White Army" to mention George Graham. Yeah. So it was certainly eventful, wasn't it? And I really look forward to reading Gareth's book, because I think it was an incredibly eventful time in our history. The Aussie time, of course, you know, he was ahead of his time, wasn't he? I think Aussie could have been Ange, couldn't he? If in different circumstances.
With better defenders.
So even though I described it as something of a sort of lost decade for me, I do remember it vividly. And it's happened, didn't they? And it maybe ended with Sugar selling and us being in a better place. So the Maxwell point's a very good one, isn't it? I'd forgotten that, really. Goodness knows what happened to us if we got into his hands. So maybe we should all be grateful to Alan.
Yeah, I think there's certain things we can be grateful for. I mean, when COVID happened and we were doing Spurs shows with absolutely no football to talk about, because there wasn't any for a while, was there? And we had to think up kind of premises for shows. And I put the hypothesis: are these the most fantastic or gifted or talented Tottenham players, geniuses since Jimmy Greaves? And I said it: Hoddle, Gascoigne, Klinsmann, Ginola and Bale. And when you think about it, three of those, they're 90s icons, aren't they? Gascoigne, Ginola and Klinsmann. So that thing about being a Tottenham fan where, okay, you don't win many trophies, but you don't half get to see some good players. And Gascoigne, like you say, Paul, his best two seasons as a footballer were undoubtedly the ones either side of Italia 90, and he wore a Spurs shirt in those. And he said himself, well, we'll see on Wednesday whether what he says, but he said he was happiest at Spurs, partly because he loved playing under Terry Venables, but he just felt good. I think partly it was to do with he was playing his best stuff, wasn't he? And he was certainly adored. I mean, we loved him, didn't we, Mitch?
Yeah, we did. It's really funny because that era, I remember sort of standing on the high road and with everyone else shouting, save the shelf. I remember all that. I remember you know, standing there saying we want Terry Venables in, not really understanding the finances, not really knowing the club was on a knife edge, that we were in boom or bust. I was just a football man. That was all I really cared about. But I was out there doing it. And it just seems, bizarre that really Sugar was the one to really take us forward. If it had gone the other way and we had gone to Maxwell, well, you know, his pensions were all, it was all backhanders. And, who knows where we would have been. So it's really a bizarre time. But for the 90s, you think about it, we won 2 trophies in that time. You know, we'd love that now.
I know. We were really pissed off at the time.
And you're right. I never thought about it. When you analyse it now, I'm looking back and I think, yeah, maybe the 90s wasn't that bad. But the perception is it was like a bleak time. And it wasn't. We won at the beginning and we won at the end. And everything in the middle, okay, some of it weren't great, you know. But by and large, you know, I'd take that now. Just get to a final, I'd take that, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah. Gareth, what did you? Were there things you found out that you weren't expecting? That you know that were kind of revelations to you that really surprised you in your research?
I think. Well, I mean, just hearing some of the stories of people who were, say, involved. I mean, Jerry Francis was very interesting to talk to, and I think probably, I mean, to be fair to him, before I spoke with him, I remember that Jerry Francis era really is that where we really dipped into mediocrity. But I mean, actually, when I spoke to him, I had a lot of sympathy for the situation that he found himself in that he really had the rug pulled from under him. That first season, that 94-5 season, he'd come in, he took on the Aussie team. We still scored lots of goals after that, but with effectively David Howells was the one who came back into the team, I guess at Dumitrescu's expense, loosely. We scored more goals, but we stopped conceding them as well, and that was a team that really could have gone somewhere. But of course Klinsmann then left at the end of that season. Nick Barmby handed in a transfer request because he was homesick and wanted to move up north again, and then Peter Popescu, who we could have built a midfield around, also decided he wanted to go to Barcelona, so
which was always his plan. I remember that about him. He turned up just as a little stepping stone, didn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. So I felt so, and the season after that we had Chris Armstrong came in, and I think he was much maligned, which is very unfair.
He was a good player.
Sheringham's their goals to game ratio as a partnership was as good as Sheringham and Klinsmann's. But then Armstrong got a bad ankle injury right at the start of the following season in August.
Yeah, 96, I remember that.
He never recovered from that.
Yeah, we had to have Rocket Ronnie Rosenthal playing up, because I remember going to David Howe's testimonial dinner.
Okay.
And that I've spoken to David Howes about this on the show. Mm. He had a massive, I mean, it was extraordinary. He had the Grosvenor House, you know, which is a huge gaff. Yeah. And there were loads of people there. And we got a table at the Grosvenor House. Everybody got absolutely smashed. And I remember we got Chris Armstrong was there, and he hadn't played for months. And me and my mate went up to him. I can't talk to footballers. I'm just completely starstruck. But my mate's the opposite. He'll talk to anyone. And he went, Chris, how you doing? Listen, Chris, how's the injury going? And he went, oh, well, you know, hopefully be back pretty soon. And he's going, oh, Chris, we really want to see you back. You know, we've really missed you. He's going, yeah. And he said, because Chris, Ronnie's shit. He's absolutely shit, Chris. Chris Armstrong's going, oh, no, lads. No, I can't. No, that's out. No, you're out of order there, lads. But that's how, you know, that was unfortunate. You're right. I thought Chris Armstrong was a good player. And I thought he was maligned because he wasn't Jürgen Klinsmann.
Yeah,
I think it was his main problem, wasn't it? And but he did score goals. But you're right. He was unfortunate with injuries, wasn't he?
It was very unfortunate. And he was signed in the same summer that Bergkamp went to Arsenal. And
another unfortunate comparison.
Yeah, I spoke to Jerry specifically about that. And I said, look, is it true that you turned down the chance to sign Bergkamp? And he said, it was never, ever going to be feasible. The amount of money that we'd have needed for the transfer would have been way out of our price range, and his wages would have been as well. And he said, to be honest with you, I had Teddy Sheringham as number 10. He said, Bergkamp would not have complimented Teddy Sheringham. He said, in my opinion, Teddy was a better goal scorer than Bergkamp, which I think he probably was. So he said, I wanted a quick striker who could play off Teddy. He said, my first choice was Les Ferdinand, who, of course, we ended up getting 2 years later for probably more money. So we got Chris Armstrong. He said, and I was happy about that because I knew that they would complement each other really well. And all the statistics show that they did.
But you've got to say fair play to Jerry Francis for even now saying, oh, I thought I made a good decision. I thought Bergkamp would have been a less good choice than Chris Armstrong. Come on, man. Come off it, Jerry. Really, Sugar should have just paid the money, shouldn't he? Because Bergkamp was a Tottenham fan. He idolised Glenn Hoddle.
He certainly idolised Glenn Hoddle. The other unfortunate miss we had, which again kind of symbolised Jerry's unfortunate time with us, is he said that he'd been tracking Emmanuel Petit, who was then at Monaco, for a year.
Yeah.
The club had agreed in principle a deal with Monaco, but they wouldn't sell him because they had this prolonged UEFA Cup run in 96-97. They said, well, we can't sell him until we're out the UEFA Cup. Now, by the time they'd got knocked out in the semi-final, the transfer window, which by then was March, not January, so they couldn't sign him. By the summer, Wenger had got his feet well under the table at Arsenal. So, I mean, famously, Petit came over, he had a really good conversation with Sugar and Francis. Yeah. They agreed in principle a deal. And then he said, well, I mean, this bit's well known, but the club paid for him to have a taxi taken back to what they thought was the airport, only for him to drop in at David Dean's house. And then time for Arsenal, and the rest is history. But, I mean, that was sort of fairly typical of Jerry Francis' time, that if Monaco got knocked out in the second round that year, he'd have signed for Spurs at the end of that 96-97 season.
Listen, Jerry Francis, top bloke, and, there's a recurring theme with managers. They'll always tell you. They all do it. This is not anything about him. They all do it. They'll all tell you all the reasons where they could have. But if it's just one thing the chairman had done, or one bit of luck here, or one bit of luck there, it would have been. Because the thing about Jerry Francis, from the fans' point of view, you know him now, so you know better than us, but the football was quite pragmatic, wasn't it, most of the time? I mean, you say we did score a lot of goals, but that's because, I mean, in Klinsmann and Sheringham, that is actually, if you think about it, it's one of the greatest Tottenham strike partnerships of all time, isn't it, for sheer quality. I mean, they were both absolutely exceptional player. I mean, Klinsmann was among the two or three best players in the world when he turned up. And Teddy just got better and better. I've always thought Klinsmann made Teddy better.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but what do you think was the best team that we had in the 90s?
Well, I would say it's the season before we won the cup final. So in 89-90, we finished third that season, which of course, you put that in the prism of modern day football, is getting into the Champions League. So we picked Arsenal on the final day of the season. That was pretty much the cup final team. But I'll say that 1991 team, Gazza was injured for large parts of the second half of the season. The year before that, which would say it was much the same team, but you could see that the team they were building. So it was Eric the Viking in goal. It was Gary Mabbott, Paul Gascoigne, and Gary Lineker. And then you had all the
hell of a spine.
That. So Paul Allen, who I know you've spoken to plenty of times before.
Yeah.
Naeem added a bit of flair, didn't he? Vinny Southwaite in. Paul Stewart was getting much better.
Stewart really came good after he went into midfield,
with us. And so the fact that we finished third that season, having beaten Arsenal, Liverpool, we beat Manchester United three times that season. We beat them twice at Old Trafford. And then beat them at home as well. You know, it took us 24 years to win at Old Trafford again after that. And Terry Venables managed the team. It wasn't quite as obvious, that sort of fluent 4-5-1 that David Pleat famously played a few years before that, but it was a really fluent team. So
it was very promising, wasn't it? And the promise in classic Tottenham, it just was never actually fulfilled. When's the book out?
So the book is out on the 22nd of April, but pre-sales are now open. So you can go in and pre-order it right now. It's currently on its way back from the printers in India on a shipping container somewhere near the Red Sea. So they're on their way up to up to the UK at the moment.
Well, even if the boat sinks or is bombed by the Houthis, you can get it on Kindle. I only read books on Kindle, so I'm sorted. Mind you, I've got a PDF, so I'm double sorted. Well, I wish you luck with it, Gareth. It sounds fantastic. And if you're a certain vintage, you're going to love it because you're going to relive it, but with more detail and more information. And if you're younger than that, you're going to love it because who doesn't love a bit of history of their club and getting context for what's going on today? And I can't wait. So as I say, I wish you luck. Gentlemen, I think we've come to an end, but I've really enjoyed talking about the old 90s. I'd like to thank you all. Excuse me. I'd like to thank you all for coming on. Paul, it's great to see you again. Thanks ever so much.
Thanks so much.
Mitch, likewise, great to see you.
No Gareth,
as I say, Gareth, good luck with the book. And we're all going to prepare and go into last minute preparations for Wednesday night with Paul Gascoigne at the Leicester Square Theatre. As I say, there are a few tickets left. Get online. The link is in the notes for this show. And all that remains for me to say, it's Theo Delaney signing off in London saying, go you Spurs!
If you want to advertise on or sponsor this show, check us out at playbackmedia.co.uk.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.